the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax. But buckle up and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. We've got a special guest, our elections analyst, Andy Jackson. And as always, it's Ray and Brooke here. Brooke, Andy, how's it going today? Today, we're going to talk Board of Election, the circus of collusion going on, Supreme Court nominees. You'll know by the time you listen to this who the nominee is. And of course, the latest Civitas polls. How y'all doing today?
Doing splendid over here. I mean, everything's like spinning all at once because we're in full swing of election season, but otherwise trying to stay sane in an insane world. What about you, Andy?
Yeah, same here. It's just a lot of stuff going on. I've actually had two post-midnight work days in a row trying to keep up with all the mess down at the Board of Elections. And unfortunately, it doesn't look like it's going to be slowing down anytime soon.
So you, Andy, are burning the midnight oil like our good friend Dallas. We were joking before we got on today how sometimes I'll get emails from Dallas at 2 and 3 in the morning, to edit something.
Yeah, it's, well, for me, since I'm more of I'm a policy guy, and policy folks, generally you get up in the morning, you do your research, you do your writing, and you go home. So it's a little unusual to have this much kind of late breaking stuff that you've got to handle. But when you get this close to the election and things start moving fast and there are so many changes, you really don't have a choice.
So let's get into it. So we keep hearing this name, Karen Brinson Bell. Who is Karen Brinson Bell? Just briefly explain for listeners out there who may not know about the Board of Elections and what it does in North Carolina.
Karen Brinson Bell is the current executive director of the North Carolina State Board of Elections. So her basic job is to enforce all the rules and regulations passed by the General Assembly and to make sure that as far as they go with elections and to make sure that elections are conducted smoothly. Brinson Bell is a protege of Gary Bartlett, who was the executive director for a couple of decades under several Democratic administrations. She was brought in by Governor Cooper a little over a year ago, and she's been doing all kinds of fun activities with the board since she's taken over.
Andy, you say fun activities, but I have a hunch you don't really mean fun. So why don't you go ahead and give us a little bit of background on what led to the only two Republicans that are on the State Board of Elections resigning this week, late in the evening. So, bring us up to speed. What has she been up to?
Real quick, ever since the concerns about coronaviruses have been going on back in March, she started trying to do as much as she could to loosen rules that protect against ballot harvesting, voting fraud, and the like, in the name of making it easier to vote. First, she tried to get the General Assembly to change the laws on such things as the witness requirement, either eliminating or reducing it to one. They actually granted that. She tried to allow boards to have basically gerrymander early voting hours so that they could assign different voting hours for different places. Certainly there's not going to be any way to game the system that way. And so the Board of Elections gave her some of the things she wanted, not everything. Then she tried to change her powers under the law by trying to change the regulations. So she presented that to this group called the Regulatory Review Commission. They flat out rejected what she wanted to do. And they even one of the members even called it a devious stunt by the Board of Elections try to get more power to unilaterally change election law. So she's on record of trying to get more power for herself to alter voting law. And then I found it quite incredible. This was reported by WRAL that she was the person that was put in charge by the State Board of Elections to negotiate a settlement on several lawsuits, one of which has been brought by this attorney, Mark Elias, who has fairly famous in political circles in North Carolina. He was Dan McCready's lawyer in the 9th District hearings. He's been suing for a whole host of things to weaken absentee ballot protections, even bringing back parts of ballot harvesting that he had fought against in the 9th District hearings last year.
But Andy, let me stop you just a second. Mm-hmm. Why in the world would the Democrats who had lost the 9th District because of that ballot harvesting want to begin to implement ballot harvesting?
Well, that's the interesting thing. I mean, the ballot harvesting has been legalized, for example, in California, and the Democratic Party has put that legalization to good use, sending people out, you know, grabbing boxfuls of ballots and dropping them off at the local boards of elections. And so this is seen as a way for Democrats to win elections. Apparently, they don't have faith in their base voters to actually vote themselves. They want to be in charge of the ballots, not leave that up to voters. And so he's got an agenda. I mean, if you go to his webpage, he'll lay out exactly what he wants. And he's suing states all over the country about this. And so Brinson Bell, who has laid out a fairly similar agenda through her request to the state board of to the General Assembly, through her attempts to expand her powers to be able to do more of the things that she had tried to get unsuccessfully from the General Assembly. They're kind of in the same, they have the same views about what should be done about absentee ballots and that sort of thing. So it was really odd that she would have been put in charge of that negotiation for a settlement. Turns out, we now have a pretty good idea of why that happened.
Let me ask you something, Andy. You know, we make the assumption that ballot harvesting helps Democrats, and certainly you pointed out California. I mean, we've seen shifts. There's, of course, been demographic shifts in California that have changed voting patterns there and who's elected to office, obviously. But why do we assume that the cheating or, for lack of a better word, the harvesting of ballots, why does it help Democrats? Why do we assume that it helps Democrats?
Well, the traditional thought is that people who are less educated, less interested in politics, tend to be Democratic. And so the idea is that, you know, the Democrats have groups of people who, for whatever reason, are not inclined to vote. If you make them passive agents, so they're not actively like, I'm going to get the ballot, I'm going to vote. But if you make them passive, you automatically receive a ballot in the mail like you do in several states. Then somebody shows up and tells you, hey, there's a ballot. Why don't you give it to me? I'll take it in for you. It's the assumption that there are disproportionate numbers of these kinds of folks that are really not interested in voting, but will hand over a ballot if you ask them for it, that are Democratic. Now, this may be shifting some because the demographics, you're getting a lot more folks without a college education, for example, that are voting Republican these days. So it might be that in the future, Republicans will be able to be just as successful at ballot harvesting, legal or otherwise, as Democrats.
Okay. And so that bit of context, and I apologize for the bunny trail, but I think it's really helpful and important for us to have that context. With that understanding of who Mark Elias is, who Karen Brinson Bell is, what is the impact of their collusion circus or theatrical collusion on the elections that led to the Republican resignations on the board?
Well, what we've got here, they have essentially eliminated the witness requirement for ballots. Because right now the cure process, the process to make sure somebody can vote, is if you send a ballot in that hasn't been witnessed, they'll send you another ballot, and you have to make sure that one is witnessed, and they'll tell you why they sent you the ballot. The first one won't count. What the settlement will replace it with is the Board of Elections simply sends a statement out saying, hey, did you send this ballot? Essentially. And then you mark that and send that back in. So it, you know, with most things, if you have a problem, the cure would be to fix the problem. This cure, as they're putting in the settlement here, doesn't actually fix the lack of a witness. There's still no witness involved here. And so it essentially removes that entirely. There are other things that they had asked for. For example, one of the items in the lawsuit was Mark Elias wanted to prevent signature verification so that people could say, well, is this the signature of the person that's, you know, sent the ballot in? Is this the actual voter? Because every voter has a signature on file. Karen Brinson Bell actually got rid of that provision on her own. She just sent a memo out to all the county boards even before the settlement happened, saying that we're not going to have any signature verification this year. So two of the ways that we have to, you know, confirm the identity of the person voting, one has been totally struck down and one has been functionally ended for people that, for whatever reason, do not have their ballots witnessed.
Andy, just one kind of final question for me. What is the lawsuit makeup going to look like? I know you're not necessarily the greatest legal expert in the entire land, but you obviously follow all these election issues. How do you see this playing out in the courts? Because I imagine this is something that's just going to kind of get spun out in various lawsuits.
Actually, the state board has authorized Brinson Bell and her staff to reach similar agreements on about a half dozen lawsuits. Now, eventually she's going to run out of things to give away because a lot of these lawsuits are covering the same territory. But the really interesting thing about this is that apparently the state board, when they authorized her to lead these negotiations, they really didn't have the full information about what was going on with these lawsuits. And for that reason, the only two Republican members of the board have resigned. Like the day after this came out, they said that we didn't have this information and we can no longer continue serving on the board. And both of them sent their resignations.
So, Andy, how do you prognosticate that this turns out, and what should our audience and voters be aware of, or do you have any marching orders for them or any calls to action?
Well, certainly what you need to do is in the short term, it'd be a good idea to contact your member of the General Assembly, House and Senate, because what we're looking at with these settlements, because there is this collusive nature to them, where two sides that agree on the goals, what they want to achieve about absentee ballots, have essentially made a kind of sweetheart deal with each other and undercut the law as written by the General Assembly. So certainly the General Assembly needs to get involved and encourage them to get involved with the lawsuit. There essentially needs to be another lawsuit to this lawsuit. And I think that's what we're probably going to see. Not allowing, you know, an attempt not to allow this settlement to go forth because it wasn't negotiated in good faith because the board members didn't have all the information they needed when they authorized Brinson Bell to make this negotiation.
That's an excellent point there, Andy. You know, I don't envy you at all going into this election. You have your work cut out for you, but I know that you're well equipped to handle this. But gosh, I mean, this election, unfortunately, I think you're going to see so many instances like this where the ends justify the means with so many individuals in power. And it looks like it's kind of shaping up to be a mess. And that, you know, not just North Carolina, but across this country, we could have obviously no decision days after the election and stuff tied up in courts. So, geez, Andy, I mean, pay attention to ncivitas.org because Andy will have all the analysis and will keep you up to date on any moving pieces, not only in this controversy, but anything having to do with North Carolina elections.
Thank you for joining us, Andy.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
All right, Brooke, let's pivot over to the latest Civitas polls that we just got back a few days ago and discuss this 2020 election because we've got some tightening races in North Carolina. We've got a lot of races that are neck and neck. Dan Forrest has also closed the gap at least a little bit, which may show some momentum for him. And, of course, Cal Cunningham has taken a few more points of a lead over Tom Tillis in the Senate race. So we've got a lot to talk about. Is there anything that surprises you or just stood out to you in the latest polls?
So I would say that the most surprising part of this to me was actually Tillis's lackluster performance against Cal Cunningham in this poll. So before, Cunningham and Tillis were neck and neck, but that is no longer the case. Cunningham has swooped in and really gained some serious momentum well outside of the margin of error. I believe it is, let me check that number real quick, but I believe Cunningham has 44% of likely voters saying that they're going to vote for him, whereas Tillis is still at 38. So he hasn't lost any support, but he hasn't gained any new support either. And one aspect of this, as I was looking in the crosstabs, that really stood out to me is that Cunningham has, among those that identify as either very conservative or conservative, 10% of their vote. 10%.
Yeah, that's probably has something to do with his military background and his Bronze Star to some degree, I would expect. That's just a speculation. And also, people just don't know much about his ideology. I think they view Cunningham as kind of a moderate and somebody who's not overtly left-leaning, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure that's what it is. He's been playing it very safe by not taking any definitive stances that would come across as rocking the boat or controversial. Honestly, it reminds me a lot of Roy Cooper. And so I think that there's something to be said about campaigning that way in a purple state. And so I've watched the past two debates between Tillis and Cunningham. And I mean, I don't think Cunningham has the best stage presence, but I'll tell you what, his political ads and the money that he has, I think it's $80 million from the Democratic Party to campaign across the state and to run these ads. I mean, that's a lot of ammo. And when people aren't that thrilled about Tillis, I mean, he had the lowest favorability among senators across the U.S. for quite some time. When people are not thrilled about Tillis, even the Republicans, some of them just won't circle the wagons. And I think that's what we're seeing. But who knows? He's still in the race, though.
Yeah, you're not a big fan of Cunningham's kind of sly Joker-like grin. But, you know, I think the problem for Tillis is that he's all over the map. He's reaching, you kind of follow on social media. He's saying this about healthcare. He's saying this about offshore drilling. He's saying this about, you know, what he's done for coronavirus. And then, you know, he supported this bill. And it seems like he doesn't have a kind of underlying message he's pounding.
No, but I was actually just on a call with two polling strategists. Mm-hmm. One of them is Bill McInturf, I think is his name. He works for NBC polling as well as Wall Street Journal. He's just an expert in these things. And then the other was a Democratic strategist. And the Democratic strategist made a good point. You know, when you're the one that's trying to take over power, you don't have power right now, you just emphasize as much as you can what you're running against. You try to get people to vote against something rather than for you. And so Cunningham might not give people an enumerated list of reasons to vote for him, accepting that he's not Tillis. And so I think that's what he's doing.
Yeah, I wonder if Tillis will look back at this race if he loses and say, and it's always in retrospect, you can look back and say you do things differently. But I wonder if he would have maybe not, he was kind of an opponent of Trump in the beginning of Trump's presidency. And of course, we all didn't know how Trump's presidency was going to turn out. You can certainly point to failures. You can certainly point to successes. But I don't think him kind of being a foe to some degree of Trump at the beginning and being this guy that was going to reach across the aisle played out well for him. So there's some distrust amongst conservatives. I think, you might have the potential where even if it's just 1 or 2% of conservatives or Republicans across North Carolina who are voting and say, I'm just going to leave this race blank because I don't like Tillis, it's obviously going to hurt him and it will cost him the election. So I don't know. I mean, if he can harness this Supreme Court race to get Cunningham and draw him out, maybe to say what kind of judges he's going to support, it may help him, obviously, if the Democrats overreach in their opposition and just end up kind of screeching about this nominee and engaging in ridiculous protests, that may end up helping Tillis. But it's hard to say. I mean, it's hard to say how it's going to shape up. I think you're right. Cunningham basically keeping his mouth shut, running a disciplined campaign with the messaging, but not saying too much about his ideology, is going to work for him. And I think that's the right strategy for him. So let's pivot to just the presidential race real quick. We had Biden, who was ahead in the last poll, Now it's neck and neck again. Statistically, Trump has a one-point lead, but that's within the margin of error. Several other polls show North Carolina, Trump with a slight lead or about even. So, again, I mean, I think it's going to be all about get out the vote. It's going to be all about, you know, what energizes North Carolinians to get out and vote. And, of course, you've got a lot of mail-in voting that's going to play a factor. But North Carolina, I think, is going to be closer than it was in 2016. I think you probably agree with that.
Yeah, I do. I think that there are – I'm getting feedback. So one thing, though, that I think is interesting here is that 8% of those that we surveyed across the state said that they were undecided as to how they were going to vote, which to me, that's pretty fascinating because you have three third-party candidates on the ballot. There's Joe Jorgensen. What's his name? Blankenship. What's his first name?
I can't remember.
And then Howie Hawkins. So Blankenship's of the Constitution Party and then Howie Hawkins of the Green Party. So you've got three different candidates outside of the binary choices that we're constantly presented with. And even so, there's still 8% that are undecided on this. And I just don't know what to think about that. But I do believe that there's that this race is going to be mighty close. North Carolina, Florida, Arizona, these are some of the states that just both candidates are campaigning hard in. Trump and Biden or his surrogates have been in North Carolina just about every week for the past month or so.
And Biden finally came back to Charlotte yesterday. So that was the first time he'd been back to North Carolina since the primary.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, but his wife, Jill, she was here, I think, last week or the week before. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens on this front. But I guess I'm a little surprised about the undecided number still because I don't know which way that would actually indicate.
Yeah, I mean, traditionally undecideds tend to break for the challenger. I mean, that, you know, I think in 2016, undecideds broke for Trump late. And he was kind of seen as a challenger because Hillary had been in politics for a long time. But, you know, Biden's been in politics for 40-something years. So it's hard to say, oh, undecideds are going to break for the challenger this time because it's just such a different election. And there's just so many different variables at play here, whether it be the law and order issue and obviously coronavirus. It's going to be hard to gauge. I mean, do you think there's still a shot, an opening for the lieutenant governor, Dan Forrest, to overtake Cooper? We saw a little bit of momentum for him. Not necessarily that his support increased, but Cooper's popularity has dropped somewhat, largely because of the school issue, largely, but also just some of the restrictions in general through coronavirus. I think a lot of North Carolinians are frustrated because we're behind a lot of other states, especially the Southeast. We see them opening up at a quicker rate, and their restrictions are not as tight, and it doesn't seem like there's any difference. You know, we're not that much safer than any other state in our region at this point. So do you think there's just some frustration settling in with a lot of voters and maybe that may end up changing some minds or shifting the momentum to Forrest at all?
I don't foresee Forrest losing any support between now and Election Day. And I think that there's, if he and his campaign play their cards right, I think there's real opportunity to make some inroads into that 12% undecided on this race. Which would give him the lead. If he were to even just, you know, make headway in half of that, he'd be nearly neck and neck with Cooper. But I like what you pointed out about Cooper's job approval. And I think this is something that our poll results in terms of who are you going to vote for governor don't show yet, but they might by the next poll. Cooper's job approval is at the lowest it has ever been the entire time we've ever polled it. Since he began his term, this is really, really noteworthy as we're nearing an election. There is increasing criticism about how he's handled the virus. There's obviously still those that are just going to stand by him no matter what. But this is definitely going to be an issue for swing voters. However, on the other hand, a criticism I have for the Forrest campaign is their decision to really focus on mask wearing. I think that that was probably the wrong approach.
Or non-mask wearing?
On opposing mask wearing.
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, it's kind of made him stand apart from the other Republican candidates across the state who are wearing masks. And it's become a needlessly divisive issue. And I just, you know, obviously maybe his campaign thought that they just needed to stick by that because they had filed that lawsuit against Cooper regarding the statewide mask mandate. But to me, that's just kind of an issue that a lot of voters aren't as concerned about. Of course, his red meat core base likes that, but he's got to appeal to a lot more people than that.
Let me ask you something. And let's say February, March of next year, if we're still required to wear masks, are you going to be wearing masks? I'm just asking, you know, kind of a personal question.
I mean, I think masks have some effect, efficacy. If not, we wouldn't be wearing them in certain medical environments. So I think that there's something to be said about it. But then my friend John Sanders at John Locke Foundation, I know he's written a lot about this, and he begs to differ on this front. And so I'm persuadable.
Do you want to be wearing a mask in February and March of 2020?
No, I don't want to be, okay. But I'll tell you what, that's not the biggest fish to fry right now.
No, I agree. I agree with you. And I don't have a problem with the mask, and I support, you know, businesses. I wish the government restrictions were a little more lenient, but I have
sure.
no problem following masked mandates or anything like that. That's not my point. But I do think there might be a palpable frustration setting in with some of the population, because I've read some stuff and vitamin D may be more effective than wearing masks, having optimum levels of vitamin D. And of course, there's different things, you know, there's different theories out there, and we're learning more about the virus all the time. Treatments are getting better. And again, I have no problem with the mask per se. I mean, you know, I tend to sometimes, I can't believe I'm admitting this, but sometimes when I talk a lot, like spittle will fly a little bit.
Uh-huh.
So it helps me.
So the masks have prevented that.
Yeah, it prevents that from happening, you know, it's sort of an embarrassing situation. So
saves you from baptizing people.
Yeah.
So. No, but yeah, I guess. And the thing is, the mask issue might, if it's around by February, I hadn't even thought about that. But if it is, yeah, I think there's some other conversations we're going to have. But I guess right now, because I get the sense that with the Supreme Court nomination at the front of everybody's mind, election integrity, which we just spoke with Andy about, like there's just so many other winning issues, school choice. There's so many other issues that the Forest campaign can focus on, and I haven't heard them do it as much, except for school choice. Definitely have heard that. So anyways, we'll see what happens. But, you know, I'm hoping that whatever happens, we're able to really just focus on fiscally conservative, socially conservative, good policies coming from our legislature and being enforced by the executive branch.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think real quick, just to wrap up the Forest bit, I mean, it seems like one of his problems, which you pointed out, is his message just doesn't get out there. And I know he's running this very grassroots-oriented campaign, but maybe it's just a lack of resources or money to run ads. But it does seem like some – because he does bring up jobs. He does bring up other issues. But it doesn't seem like it just gets out there. And I think part of that may just be the media blowback to focus
– yeah.
You know, they're so heavily focused on coronavirus, they're going to – you know, define Forrest that way. And because of some of the positions, like you said, he's taken, it's just going to be the focus of his
yes.
campaign, fair or unfair. I mean, that's just the reality of the situation. Let's conclude, Brooke. By the time people are listening to this, unless something drastic or unexpected happens, they should know who the Supreme Court nominee is. But Trump has said that he's going to announce a Supreme Court, a female nominee to replace the recently deceased Ruth Bader Ginsburg on Saturday. I don't remember which time, but he is going to name a replacement. Who do you expect it to be? I mean, we're offering a prediction, and so we'll be proven right or wrong by this podcast by the time it airs.
Oh, yay. I love being held to my predictions and prognostications. I really think it's probably going to be Amy Coney Barrett. And the reason I think it's her is because of the thorough vetting process she's already gone through, especially during the Kavanaugh time when her name was being floated. And so I think that she's well qualified, as are the other two candidates. But I think that she just makes the most sense, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, there's certain some demographic and some ideological, you know, Trump, a lot of the Trump's base want her nominated. Of course, I wrote a piece on Alison Jones Rushing, who is from North Carolina, was born in Flat Rock, so from Western North Carolina, and it was a clerk to Gorsuch on the federal the 10th Circuit for the Federal Appeals Court, and Supreme Court Clarence Thomas. She's only 38 years old. She's considered a dark horse candidate. You can read that article at nccivitas.org. I give some background about her. I'm actually convinced, Brooke, that she may be the most conservative of the three, meaning Amy Coney Barrett, Barbara Lagoa from Florida, who's a Cuban-American, and, of course, Rushing from Western North Carolina. I say that because of some off-the-record conversations I've had with some attorneys, but essentially, there are no evangelicals on the court. Privately, she may be at least strongly evangelical, and obviously her background clerking for Thomas. Thomas is considered the most conservative jurist, and if he was a heavy influence on her, then it would certainly point to her potentially being the most conservative justice. She's only 38, the youngest federal appeals court judge in the entire nation. So sure, hers is a name we'll hear from again, even if she's not nominated by Trump on Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, to be 38 years old and that accomplished, I'm just amazed. And yeah, that was a really good piece that you did on her. And so our audience can find that at nccivitas.org. That's a great piece. And we've got a lot of other content as well as these poll results underneath the poll tab on our homepage. And so plenty to talk about between now and Election Day. And we hope you guys continue to remain loyal listeners of Civitalk so you can stay up on the latest of what's happening here in our old North State. We'll talk to you later.